All right, here we go. All right, good afternoon, sir. Thank you for agreeing to be interviewed today for the Preservers, Pathbreakers, and Pioneers branch of the Wisdom Project. As we've already discussed, my name is Queen Stevenson, and I am an undergraduate student at Vanderbilt. The interview I will be conducting today will be broken into roughly four sections. I will outline each of them in a moment, but for now, it's most important for you to know that you do not need to be concerned with answering the exact questions, or with taking too long to answer, or with answering fully. Instead, we want you to tell your story in the way that you choose. And you can feel free to answer or not answer any question or any part of any question at any time. You can also go back and clarify and expand as you like. Although I will be asking questions from an interview guide here, meant to make sure that we touch on certain parts of your life, we don't need to follow a strict script. The aim for this is to be more like you telling your story than a formal interview. And so, I realize that you've already signed the consent form, but you should also feel free to tell me during or after the interview if there is anything that you say that you would like to keep out of the interview, out of the educational, digital archive, or presentation materials to be created based on these interviews. So I'm going to go over the outline of the interview. So the first section of this is just going to be basic biographical questions and questions about your family and your background. The second section is about your role as a pioneer, especially your education and your work life. The third section is just going to be a place for following up, where we may go back to anything that you said about your background. And the fourth section is where I'll ask you for wisdom that you would like to pass on to young people like me and future generations. So, do you have any questions about those sections? All right. We're ready to go. So first, we have background and basic biography. Sir, so when and where were you born?
Well, as far as I can ascertain, without any recorded records, I was born in Clarksville, Tennessee. And that was about January 25th, 1928.
So do you have any kind of formal birth records, or you just know that by...
Well, as far as we could ascertain from from the early 25 years, I didn't know whether I had a birth certificate or not, because it never came up. But after finishing college and getting drafted into the Army, and I came back, I thought about it, and I wondered, did I have a birth certificate? So I spoke to my parents about it, and they had no knowledge of my ever having a birth certificate. So I wrote to the Department of Vital Statistics in Nashville and asked them if they had any recording of me ever having been born in the state of Tennessee, and they had no records. And then they advised me that if I could send them my name, birth date, and my mother and father's name, that they could provide me with birth certificates. So I sent them that information, and they sent me a copy of the birth certificate. Of course, they kept the original there with themselves in the Vital Statistics Department.
And when did you request for this information?
Well, that was in 1955.
Was there any event that kind of prompted you to reach out for this information, or you were just curious?
Yes, I had been in the military, and I was seeking employment. Mm-hmm. And I thought that someone was eventually going to ask me for a birth certificate. And since I didn't have one anyway, I thought I would try and secure one. And it was easier than I had anticipated. They only wanted to know what my mother's maiden name was and where she was born and my father's name. And if they were living together at this particular time, at that particular time. And of course they were and had been, you know, all of my life.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, next question. How would you define yourself in terms of racial and ethnic identity?
Well, at this point in time, it's questionable, I guess you would say. Excuse me. I started out as being colored. And of course, later on, they brought out the term Negro. And in recent years, they came around to African American. So I guess you could say I'm all three. But I prefer African American.
So you talk about this kind of constant shifting of racial identity. Did that ever make you feel weird or like you weren't yourself because it was always someone else deciding your identity for you?
Yes, I have always felt kind of, you know, strange and unusual as far as identity was concerned, because I've always just felt like you're just human and that you're just an individual. So wherever you were born, that's what you should be, you know, determined. What ethnic group you should belong to and what your parents were. And since I was born in America, then American, I'm really an American, that's all. They could take all of those other labels off and just say American.
I agree. So speaking of parents and where you're from, where were your parents and grandparents born and where did they live?
Well, on my mother's side, my mother, her mother, and father were born in Tennessee, Montgomery County, Tennessee. That's the description that they gave of their early residence. And of course, in the early 40s, that area was purchased by the government to build an army camp. And so they were forced to move from that area.
And what about your father's side?
Well, my father's side, my father was said to have been born in Kentucky, Hopkinsville, Kentucky. But now his mother and father lived in Clarksville. I never knew them because they passed on before I was born. But he had a sister and a couple of brothers. And I didn't see them either. They had passed on, but I had recollection of his sister because she lived quite a while. And I knew her personally. Used to visit his sister. Her name was Maddie Adams Reeves. And my father's name was Matthew Adams. His mother was named Violet Allen Adams. And of course, his father was named Nicholas Adams. Now, Nicholas was a slave, and so he was confined, as the slaves were back in 1862, on up to 1865. And the records show that he was born in Tennessee. He didn't say where, it just said in Tennessee. And the only recording I have of that is from his army discharge. Now, they recruited slaves during the Civil War because the army was limited at that particular time. They were all volunteers. And as the battle got a little bit rough, and they were losing so many soldiers doing that fighting that they allowed the slaves to volunteer to join the army. So Nicholas volunteered to join the Army at the age of 22. And he joined the Army in Gallatin, Tennessee, according to his Army discharge. And he stayed there until from 1862 to 1865. And then he was discharged and freed when Abraham Lincoln signed an Emancipation Proclamation. And from that time on, it was said that he lived in Clarksville. I don't have any record of when he passed away, but he lived on Marion Street, and I remember the house and the location because his sister lived there until in the late 40s. I knew her quite well because we used to visit her about once a week. And she was married to a man named Will Reeves, and they didn't have any children. So my father had 6 children, 5 boys and 1 girl.
And Nicholas Adams, is that your great-grandfather?
My grandfather. Your grandfather. So I'm just one generation from slavery.
Wow. Did you ever have conversations with him?
No, he had passed on.
He passed on, yeah, okay.
But I got the record of when he was discharged at Chattanooga, Tennessee in 1865 after spending 2 years in the Army. And that his mother lived at the same place that his sister lived, and that his mother left the house to his sister when she passed on. And so that's how I know these few things that I do, because I knew the sister. She lived on until the 40s.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And she had a stroke and was brought to our home where she lived until she passed. And of course, my father was the longest liver. He lived until 1957, Matthew. He was a good man, a good fellow, and a good friend to the neighbors. He loved to hunt and fish. And he had been in the Army. He was in the Spanish-American War. So he was a veteran. And three of my brothers, the oldest three, were in World War II. Granddaddy in Civil War, father in Spanish-American War. And then I came along. I was in the Korea, 1953 to 1955. So all the Adams men were part of the military. Grandpa, Dad, 3 brothers, and myself. We, I guess, would be called the Fighting Adams.
So you said that all the men in your family were military men. So what were your strongest memories of your parents and grandparents? Were those memories founded in the military or nothing?
No, they were just ordinary people. Grew up on a farm because, see, that's where my grandparents on my mother's side lived. They lived on a farm. So naturally, my mother and father had been farmers likewise. But when my father's mother became ill, who lived in Clarksville, my mother and her older sister happened to be next door neighbors. And so my mother, who hadn't been married at that time, would help taking care of my father's mother, who was sick, as a next door neighbor. Well, she and my dad got acquainted, and later on they got married. And then here comes these six children. I'm the last one. That's a long story. But we'll get to the end of it. I'm the youngest of the six children. There were five boys and one girl. And the oldest boy didn't live too long. He lived to be 19. And he passed away. He was kind of sickly, and he had a serious seizure one day and just passed away. But the rest of the family lived on for quite a while. The next oldest brother attended elementary and high school, was an excellent basketball player. And he finished high school and attended Tennessee State, which was a college at that time. And he only went for 2 years, and then he went out to Howard for a while. And then he dropped out from Howard and went to work in Detroit, Michigan. And he lived there until 1985. That's the next oldest boy. Then the third oldest one attended Wilberforce University for 2 years. Was drafted into the Army, came back and went to Howard University in Washington, D.C. He graduated in 1946 as a pharmacist, moved to California, Los Angeles, and worked for some pharmacy company for several years, and then he opened up his own pharmacy store. For several years he did quite well, and then they had the riot, the Watts riot, and they burned down everything in the neighborhood but his store. But he had no trade coming in because everybody else had left the neighborhood. So after 4 or 5 years, he closed his store and went to work for another company, Thrifty Drug Company, where he stayed for about 46 years, I think it was. And then he retired. And he lived there in California, he, his wife, and 2 children. Until he was about 65 years old, or 66. And he had a weak heart. He had an operation, and the process didn't hold but one day. So he passed away the day after his operation. And the next oldest brother was employed and working at Fort Campbell, and he was drafted back in 1941. So he came out and moved to Detroit, Michigan, married, and worked for Chrysler Corporation, where they worked on the missiles, parts, providing parts for those missiles that we used to send up, weather observation, other things. And I imagine it has to do something with some of this technology that we have now, where we are getting the computers and the iPods and all these other things from. I was on the plane one time and was speaking to one of the pilots who was not working that day, he was just traveling. And I asked him, how did they determine where they were going up there in the air? And he said, you know, they have satellites up there. And those satellites have things like spotlights that put out beams, and the pilots get on those beams and that shows them which direction to go. I said, well, that was a reasonable explanation for someone who didn't quite understand how planes fly. It's like highways up in the sky. Isn't that wonderful?
I like that.
They travel many times a day, every year. and you seldom hear of an accident. Seldom hear of an accident of all of those planes. Yeah. Well, my sister was the next oldest, and so she was between me and the third oldest. But she attended Tennessee State for 3 years. Dropped out, got married, moved to Indianapolis, Indiana. She started into the nursing field. So she stayed there about 3 years as a nurse. And then moved on to California where my other brother was living. And she went to nursing school there at Los Angeles Junior College and got certified as a licensed practical nurse. And after about 4 years, she decided she wanted to become an occupational nurse. And so then she went on and got her certificate as a licensed occupational nurse. And then here I come, pulling up the end, the last one in the bucket. I'm a little quiet. Soft-spoken, easy-going, happy-go-lucky kid. They tell me that I used to sit on the floor in the kitchen and beat on the pots and pans with the spoons and knives. Of course, you know I don't remember that far back. But my brother that lives in Detroit now is 92, and he tells me that, yes, you did just what I said you did. So we have a good laugh, and then I tell him, well, you know, I didn't stay that way. Although I was reluctant to go to school at an early age, I stayed in and made a pretty good student of myself. Finished elementary school, went on to finish high school, became a better-than-average basketball player, was voted the captain of the basketball team, and then went on and played 1 year of football because they disbanded football during the war. And we started it back up my last year, so I got to play 1 year of football and was the co-captain of the football team. So I was a pretty good athlete. I didn't brag on myself or anything, but I was pretty good. Had a lot of fun at the sport and making lifelong friendships. And some of those fellas that we ran around with and played with at that time are still my best friends. And one of the fellas that was on the first team with me for 4 years lives in Chicago now, just about 6 blocks from where I live. So we see each other occasionally at church. We both attend the same church. And then one of the other fellas that was one of my classmates still lives in Clarksville. So whenever I go there to visit, he comes by and picks me up, takes me out to his home, shows me around the city. And the city has changed. It's not near the city that it used to be. When I was young, like 10, 12 years old, the city only had about 12,000 inhabitants. But when they built Fort Campbell, Kentucky there, they built that camp and brought in a lot of military personnel. And then different companies came down to build. And the town expanded on both ends. And so it has expanded 2 or 3 times since the 40s when they built the camp. So now there's about 350,000 people there. Can you imagine from 12,000 to over 300,000? It's quite a city now, considered the best little town in Middle Tennessee. That's Clarksville, Tennessee, my home. And our old home place is still there. My father built the house before I was born. They said it was a miracle that he got it completed, because he was working at a regular job at the American Stuff Company. And he'd come home every evening and do a little work on the house before dark. But the house is still standing. People are still living there. And it looks better now than it did when I lived there. And I left there in 1955. That's when I came to Chicago. And when I went into the Army, I had been working in Cincinnati, Ohio. That was my first professional job, as a senior social worker in Cincinnati, Ohio. Upon graduation from Tennessee State for the master's degree in 1953, one of my college professors said, "Adam, say, you look like you might make a good social worker. You ever thought about going into social work?" I said, "No, I hadn't thought about it." He said, "Well, you might want to think about it." I was taking a class in social administration under him, and I'm a sociology minor. So I was taking social administration, and I thought about it, and he said, "Well, I'm going to bring you some information." He brought me a company's placement agency in New York City, phone number and address, and I wrote them a letter and told them I was going to be graduating soon, that I would like to know if they had any openings or any applications available, that there might be some openings anytime soon. So a couple of weeks before graduation, I got a letter saying that they had an opening in Cincinnati, Ohio, if I would be interested to let them know. So I immediately let them know, and they asked me if I would come up for an interview. So I went to Cincinnati for the interview, and they hired me as a senior social worker. And my job was to supervise and to plan activities for kids after school, recreation, in a settlement agency. It was a two-story house with two rooms where they had the activities and a small playground outside the building. So they were anxious to hire me, and of course, just coming out of college, I was glad to get the job, so I accepted the job. But in about 8 weeks, I got my papers to report to the military for induction, as I had been deferred while I stayed in school. Somehow they got the word that I had finished, I had completed the time in school. So I came home and went on to the Army, and then when I got out of the Army, they didn't have an opening for me back at that job. Said they had hired somebody 2 years before, and it didn't have an opening. So I went on home without a job. Thought about this place that had sent me there in the first place. I found the address and phone and called them, and they sent me information that there was an opening in Chicago as an athletic director or a settlement agency quite similar to the one in Cincinnati. Would I like to come up for an interview? I said, "Well, I just got out of the military and I don't have a car, don't have a job, and don't have money for transportation." He said, "Well, we'll send you a bus fare." So I said, "Please do." They sent me a bus fare to Chicago, and I came and had the interview. And I don't know, I guess they were impressed somehow. So they hired me. and said they had already put my name on the program for the year. They just anticipated that I would be the one that would come and accept the job. And so when they showed me my program, sure enough, my name was on the program. So I stayed there from 1955 to 1959. And it was called Henry Booth House. It was a settlement agency similar to Hull House. You may have heard of Hull House. They had activities for people, young people from 9 years of age to 19. And so I was responsible for planning, conducting and supervising groups of children and young people in after school activities and on the summer playground. That went on for four good years, and so after that, I decided that I wasn't advancing. I was just a steady worker in one position, and there were no raises. So I decided I would try something else. So I applied for the Board of Education, and they hired me on the spot to teach in elementary schools.
This is in
1959? 1959. October 1959. So I taught 7th and 8th grade students in one classroom, 48 students. Double shift. That means there's two shifts each day, two different teachers, one in the morning shift, one in the afternoon. And the seats were boarded to the floor. You couldn't move your seats. 48 students. First class from 8:15 to 12. Second class from 12 to 3:15. I enjoyed that. But they had what you call a split level class. They had 7A and 7B. 8A and 8B. So that would be the lower group in the A's and the higher group in the B's. And so I accepted the 8th grade and the 8th hour schedule. And another gentleman took the afternoon shift. And of course, they built a new school about 3 blocks from where this school was. And we transferred classes that we had from school A to school B, which was another school, and they called it an upper grade center. It only had 7th and 8th grades. It's like a junior high school. We had 800 students, 45 teachers. And it was a beautiful type of school, run like a junior high school. We had all types of activities. Had home economics for the young ladies and had woodshop for the boys. They had the school band, physical ed for the girls, physical ed for the boys, and the regular classes of English, math, science, art, homemaking. So that was quite an experience. And I stayed there from 60 to 71. And I thought it was time to move on. I had been serving as an acting assistant principal for, I guess, 8 or 9 years. And the school administration decided that they were going to bring in a regular assistant. And so they did. They brought in a regular assistant. And I was invited to come out to a new school, which was a different school, but not a new school, to be a regular assistant principal. And of course, I accepted that offer. So I moved out to that school in 1971 as the assistant principal. Yeah, it was upper grade center. I just had 7th and 8th graders for the first 3 years, and then they brought in 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 6th graders, and it became a middle school. And I remained there until I retired, which was in 1985. Of course, while there, I worked as a football coach for the high school that was adjoining this school. They brought in a new coach, and he didn't have any assistants, and so I joined him and became an assistant football coach. And that was quite an experience. I had always wanted to be a coach, and I had always hoped to be a coach someday. So that was my opportunity. It was in my system, and I got it out. I worked with the coach for a time there. And then they built a new high school, which moved away from where my school was. So I wasn't clear enough, close enough to the high school to continue with them. So I gave up the coaching after a year of coaching with them. And I remained there. And of course, between 1971 and my retirement, the principal of the school left the school to take up a job at one of the universities. So then I was placed in as the principal, 1973. So I served as a principal, 1973, 1974. And they brought in a tenured principal. And I became back in my old slot as the assistant principal, and remained there until 1985 as I retired. That was quite an experience. I had always kind of hoped that someday I could get to be a principal. I didn't really expect it to happen after, you know, having been in the system for quite a few years. But that's the basis of my professional experience. And now some of the things we did as children, though, are unbelievable. You know, as kids growing up around Clarksville, there wasn't a whole lot to do. So you had to kind of make your own fun, make your own games and things to play. And so we used to just use a tin can. We'd call what you call kick the can. You draw a circle, put the can in the middle, kicked the can. And then everybody else who's playing goes and hides. And one person who is it has to go get the can, bring it back, set it up in the circle, and then go find those who are hit. In the meantime, while you're trying to find one, somebody else tries to sneak up and kick the can out of the circle. Well, that goes on and on until somebody else gets caught. And then they have to take the place. They're it. And then on Halloween, of course, you would ring people's doorbells and then run around behind the house. Or you turn the chairs over, upside down. But on one particular Halloween, and the most unusual thing happened that I've never been able to figure out. One of the old gentlemen at the top of the hill, that street I lived on, had a horse and a mule. He used to haul things for people. But some of the older teenage boys took the man's wagon one night, Halloween, and they put that wagon up on top of the school building, two stories high. Now, we haven't figured out yet, my brother hasn't figured out yet, how they got the wagon up on top of the two-story building. Well, the police couldn't find out, but they found the boys, and so they make them take it down, so they took it down. But nobody ever told how they got it up there. That's a real stunt, if you ever saw one. And of course, you know, kids will be kids. They used to throw a rock on top of your house and then run, hide behind a tree. Knock on your door. Duck down behind the hedges. As soon as you come turn your light on and see who it is and you don't see anybody, you go back in and they knock again. And then we used to make our own games. Sometimes we didn't have a ball to play with, so we'd just get some old stockings, socks, ball them up, roll them up real tight. Take some black tape, tape it, make it real stiff and hard, and use that for a ball. And then sometimes if you wanted to play basketball, we'd just take something like a tennis ball, because no one had a basketball. And you would just use a tennis ball. And you didn't have a basket, so you'd use an old wheel from somebody's wagon. Just nail it up on the back end of your house and play with the tennis ball. And my brother played basketball a couple of years ahead of me. And he said they did the same thing that we did. They didn't have a ball either. They just played with that. And the football, they used a tin can. They didn't have football. You know, the tin can would do the same thing that the ball would do if you throw it like that. So we used to do that too. We used to take a tin can and play football with it because nobody had the football. In the later years, kids, you know, began to come up with some of the balls and bats and things like that that you could play with. But some of the things my sister and some of our friends, when we were very young, used to just play with jacks and pick-up sticks, things like that. You know, the little sticks come in a little package. You have about two dozen. You hold them up and let them fall. You take one and try to pull the others away without disturbing the others. And that's the pickup sticks. And then jacks, little jacks, little metal things that you can spin around with your fingers. You throw one up and pick up one. And of course, we used to take a cigar box and drill a hole in the middle of it. And you would hold a marble up near your waist. It had to be up near your waist. And try to drop it through that hole. You got it in the hole, then person had to give you another marble. If it didn't go in, then the other person who had the box got to keep the. As long as you drop it in, you got another. If you didn't, then the other person got to keep it. And of course, we had the old car tiles. If you could find the car tile anywhere on the side of the street or in the trash pile, you just roll it down the street with your hand. Nobody else had one but you. Every now and then you meet somebody else come up the other way, he had found one, see? So you're playing with your car tile. And of course, we used to make the skate trucks. You had skates that had gone bad. You could take them apart. There was two pieces to a skate. In the middle was a little screw with a little nut on it. You could unscrew it and you had two halves. You put one half at the top, at the front, and the other half at the back. And you had what you call a skate trunk. You nail that to a piece of wood. That's where the skateboards came from. And of course, if you want to make a skate truck, then you put a piece in the front. And it went up the front. Went up the front like this. So that was called a skate truck. You nail a board up here and you put a little cross piece there with your handlebars. And of course, you put the same, you know, the skate under the bottom. So that's about, I guess, what I can think of. My family, I guess you want to know about that one, says I married one of my college friends that I met in 1953 while at Tennessee State. She happened to be attending summer school, and I was in graduate school. We got acquainted, and I went on to the military and come back, and after those 2 years, we got married in 1955, September. And we stayed together until she passed, which was in 2012. 56 years. And Sharonice is our daughter. And Sharita is my granddaughter. Harold's my son-in-law. That's my family. Of course, the other brother, just the two of us left out of the five boys and one girl. So my other brother lives in Detroit, and he has retired. He's 92 now, and his wife passed year before last. So he lives alone, and I live alone. So I come down here and spend time with them whenever I get a chance. And I have no limitations. I stay 2 weeks, 2 months. 3 weeks, whenever. So, I've been here now since the first week in May. Don't know when I'm going back home, but I've got to go back because I have a house sitting there full of furniture and everything I own is there. So I'll be here about, I guess, another month or so, and then I'll be going back home. Maybe we can take a break here.
Absolutely.
All right, now recharge my battery. Just drink of water.
I would